world's wealthiest woman is also the world's most pirated author. And to protect her new adult market novel, J.K. Rowling is trying to put a spell on would-be pirates. Another author known for work catering to kids is also out to grow his audience, and we hear whether he succeeds. The answer from a PW reviewer may give the author goosebumps. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance and his podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and every week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of news that everyone in publishing will be talking about. Joining me from PW's New York office is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's features editor. And Andrew, welcome back.
Greetings, Chris.
Well, it's good to have you join us. And you have a fascinating twist on news related to the book coming out from J.K. Rowling. Her piracy fears are almost legendary. And I understand that she's made an interesting, even controversial decision regarding her latest book, her first non-Harry Potter novel called The Casual Vacancy. Tell us more about that.
That's right. So in Monday's issue, our Rachel Deal reports on a really fascinating, unusual move by Rowling's team regarding that new book, The Casual Vacancy, which is, you know, her first attempt at contemporary fiction. Now, as you know, Rowling's concern over piracy has been very public. She famously refused to allow the Harry Potter series to be made available in digital format for years, citing piracy concerns. And now with her first contemporary novel, which publishes in September in the U.S., her agency is proactively trying to tamp down the possibility of the book being ripped and shared by withholding the manuscript from publishers and territories that are considered high risk for piracy. And that's a move that's kind of rankled international publishers who say that's going to leave them scrambling to get translations ready for the holiday season. You want to read Rachel's piece on Monday for all the details. There's some really excellent reporting there. But I can't resist a few observations of my own, of course. The first is that it seems like Rowling or her team is ignoring her own experience with the Potter series, shall we say. While she denied the world official digital versions of the Potter series, that didn't stop the book from being pirated, and in fact, it probably only led to more pirated editions, because people couldn't buy the ebook. In this case, you can easily see how denying publishers and these Tories access to the manuscript is going to end up leading to more amateur translations being posted in haste. As Chad Post notes, Chad Post, who is the blogger who blogs at 3%, it could certainly also lead to, subpar official license translations and hampered marketing efforts, because those foreign houses are going to be compelled to rush their work when they finally do get the manuscript. For my money, Chad, who I think is one of the great voices in translation publishing, has an excellent point. And there's another observation I'll add, and that's that this isn't Harry Potter. This is Rowling's first attempt at contemporary fiction, and as such, I think she has a high hurdle to clear to get readers who loved Harry Potter to read this book. And how she, decides to start off this new phase of career by, ankling foreign publishers right out of the gate, I question that. Frankly, I don't think you're going to see a flood of people who are just dying to pirate J.K. Rowling's non-Harry Potter effort. And even if that did happen, it might be one of those good problems. As consultant Brian Leary always likes to make what I call the most unpopular argument in publishing, sometimes piracy isn't always bad. And in this case, you could actually see how, that kind of enthusiasm among Rowling fans for this new effort might help her to move on from her Harry Potter days. Now, before anyone starts sending me nasty email, I'm not endorsing that anybody who can't get the manuscript, pirate an edition of this book and translate it. But I am questioning the harm versus the benefits of this move, because I would think that establishing Rowling as a writer of contemporary fiction would outweigh the risk of piracy in this case. And in the same way that not releasing ebook editions of Harry Potter didn't stop it from becoming the most pirated book on the web, I think denying the manuscript here to foreign publishers really only increases the risk of seeing a crappy amateur pirated translation emerge before a good licensed translation.
Yeah, well, they're all really interesting points, in it, and it's going to be something to watch to see how this all plays out. But I have to tell you, Andrew, I think that she's not going to have any trouble finding readers anywhere in the world. If they find out it's a new book from J.K. Rowling, they're going to buy it no matter whether it's about Harry Potter or not. That's my guess. Now, Andrew, you're not an attorney. You don't even play one on TV, but you sure hang out with a lot of them, and you sure talk about a lot of legal cases. We've got more news, of course. The one that everyone in publishing is talking about is the Department of Justice case in the so-called Apple price-fixing suit. Tell us where we stand now.
Yeah, you know, every week there's another something to write about with these things. I feel like I've been, you know, going to law school for the past, you know, 6 or 7 years at PW, and I've had some great teachers too, I have to
add. And not a single loan to worry about.
That's true too. So yeah, let's talk about the Apple price-fixing stuff first. You know, as you know, at the end of last week, the Department of Justice filed its response, along with publishing the more than 800 comments it received on the proposed settlement with three publishers over that alleged price-fixing scheme. Now, to no one's surprise, the DOJ discounted the objections and said it was moving ahead with the settlement. Well, DOJ officials told us this week that they're going to officially ask the court by August 3rd to approve that deal. And after that, we're going to have more filings, including responses from publishers. You know, so the bottom line there is that no one really knows how long it's going to take for this deal to actually get approved by the court and to go into practice. Now, if you're following the case, and you know, if you haven't already done so, I would urge you to read the DOJ's response to the comments. They really are quite interesting. Personally, I still think the DOJ fundamentally misunderstands the ebook market. However, their response to the comments that were submitted, very interesting stuff. I think they sort of point out how the objectors, the people who would object to the settlement, kind of missed the point of the suit. The filings by booksellers and the authors, like such as the Authors Guild or the ABA, etc., they all talked mostly about the agency model and how this was going to affect the state of the industry. But the DOJ lawyers pointed out that it's really only concerned with consumers. Antitrust, they argue, is designed to protect competition, not competitors. And this was something we've been talking about at PW here as these comments kind of rolled in and we started seeing new ones and we're reporting on new ones as they happened, that for all the focus in the letters on the health of the industry and the benefits of the agency model, the focus really should have been more on, you know, the effect on consumers. And indeed, there's a pretty strong argument to be made there. Nevertheless, at the same time, I don't think anyone believes that the DOJ was going to back off its case, even if the letters and comments had been tailored to address the consumer aspect more than the industry aspect. You know, at the same time, let's not forget there's a consumer class action at work here, too. And in that case, Penguin this week lodged an appeal of a recent ruling against them. You know, you may recall back in March, Penguin sought to actually stay the consumer class action case, arguing that Amazon and Barnes & Noble ebook purchasers expressly agreed in their license agreements when they bought ebooks to arbitrate any claims arising from their ebook purchases. Judge Cote, however, denied that motion, finding that those end-user license agreements that might otherwise be enforceable are in fact invalid here because they would prevent ebook consumers from vindicating their rights under the Sherman Act. Cote also found that class action was a good mechanism in this case because it was economically irrational, she said, Judge Cote said, to force the vast number of individual ebook purchasers to actually, you know, arbitrate their individual claims. You know, we don't know how the appeal or when the appeal is actually going to play out, but I think the appeal is interesting for many reasons, but to me, I think it casts light on some of the often pretty sweeping, outrageous parts of end-user license agreements, which, of course, no one ever reads before they agree to, such as, you know, clicking on something that agrees that you would never, ever, take a court, someone to court over this stuff, that you have to arbitrate everything. You know, that has always seemed like sort of an overreach to me, and I think that's going to be part of what's going to factor into this appeal.
Well, again, a nice summary. I mean, the point regarding how the DOJ see things is different, quite different from the way publishers view it, I think is one worth considering even further. And, you know, Andrew, I'm surprised that you actually used the word Sherman Act in a sentence here. I never expected that from Andrew Albanese of Publishers Weekly.
I'm quite... I'm getting quite familiar with the Sherman Act, even though
I bet you are more familiar than you ever thought you would be. And then finally, there's yet another case against Google that we've been following. You've talked a lot about the goings on in Judge Chin's courtroom, but this is a little different. This is the Authors Guild versus HathiTrust. And tell us where we are for that.
Well, actually, there's developments in both cases that we're going to see at the end of this week. You know, last week we saw more filings in the Authors Guild versus the HathiTrust case, and there's more filings that are actually due today in that case. Responses to the opposition briefs that I reported on last week. In addition, the summary judgment filings in the Authors Guild versus the Google case are also due today. So it's going to be a long weekend of reading and writing for me. And you'll be sure to check out those reports in publishersweekly.com next week. But a couple of things to know on these things. I'm really very interested in seeing the filings in the Authors Guild case against Google, as there are a number of differences in that program from the Authors Guild case against the HathiTrust, for example. And remember, that class action status in the Google case, HathiTrust, the Google case is under appeal. So I'm curious to see what the Google summary judgment motions might say about potential class issues there. And meanwhile, back to the library case for a second. After looking through a lot of the evidence, there were thousands of pages of documents there, at least looking at the stuff that wasn't redacted. It seems to me like the libraries are starting to build a bit of an advantage there. As it stands, HathiTrust lawyers have a pretty good case for fair use that they can point to. This thing exists. It's out there functioning in the real world. People are using it. It's transforming research, and there's no content that's actually being viewed by people. It's just an index. The Authors Guild, on the other hand, in its evidence, doesn't seem to be able to point to any existing harm, only to the potential that this thing might be hacked. And I wonder if, it's worth, shutting down this massively beneficial search engine because Congress didn't explicitly authorize its creation. We'll see how that all plays out after this latest round of filings. But, I tend to think the libraries are starting to build an advantage there. In any case, that case is going to be fully briefed after Friday and on its way to trial in November. So, you can look for more on all these cases at publishersweekly.com next week. I'm sure I'll have pages and pages of stuff.
All right. Well, have a good weekend with those briefs. And Andrew Albanese, as always, thank you for joining us on Beyond the Book with your wrap-up of the news.
Thank you, Chris.
And now I want to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris. Always nice to be here.
Yeah, well, we're happy to have you join us because you brought a lot of books with you and some interesting titles indeed. What have you got this week?
In fiction, we have The Yellow Birds. This is the debut novel from poet and former Army machine gunner Kevin Powers. It's not a combination you see every day. Our reviewer says it's a moving study of combat, guilt, and friendship forged under fire. We also have Lawrence Osborne's book, The Forgiven. He portrays the vacuity of high society as gorgeously and incisively as he does the unease of cultures thrust together in the unforgiving Moroccan desert. And we also have a fiction Q&A with Pacific Northwest author Lydia Nyutnovich, who talks to us about her debut novel, Dora, A Head Cased. She took inspiration from one of Sigmund Freud's case studies about an adolescent bisexual patient whose father had hired Freud to treat his daughter after she'd stopped speaking. And Nyutnovich read the case at 25, said she always knew that she would write something someday where she would give Dora back her voice and let her talk back to Freud.
Well, in mysteries, the first title you're going to tell us about really sounds grisly.
Yeah, this is Anne Perry's 18th William Monk historical. It's A Sunless Sea. And Monk, who's the commander of the Thames River Police, investigates the murder of a woman found eviscerated on an East London pier. But this is much more than a whodunit. This mystery, which we think is possibly Perry's best yet, provides a nuanced look at a vital controversy of the day, which is the role of opium in Victorian society. So lots of depth there, not just gore. We also review Charles Robbins's first novel, The Accomplice. Press Secretary Henry Hatton accepts a top spot in the presidential campaign of a moderate Republican senator who unfortunately has some flaws that afflict many powerful men, such as a taste for beautiful women other than his wife, and a tendency to cross lines that are at least unethical and sometimes illegal. In the current campaign season, this political thriller is a must-read. And we have a Q&A with Michael Cardos, who's the author of the debut thriller, The Three-Day Affair, that centers on a spur-of-the-moment kidnapping. And when he was asked if any of the characters resemble himself, the author replied, "Like my protagonist, I know what it's like to be in a rock band that doesn't pay the bills." That's about it, though.
Well, in my intro, Rose, I previewed the new book from Errol Stein, and tell us what PW thinks of it.
Yeah, so this is one of those places where I appreciate working for a magazine that isn't afraid to write negative reviews. R.L. Stine is the creator of the Goosebumps series for kids and young adults. Now that his early fans are all grown up, he's trying his hand at horror for adults. But in Red Rain, doesn't work out quite as well as he might have hoped. So the premise of the book is that two spooky children are terrorizing a small town protected by their adoptive mother, and she tries to rein in their destructive impulses, even as her husband and other children are targeted. Unfortunately, our reviewer says the story just doesn't hold together. It relies too heavily on cliches and often feels like it's pulling stuff straight out of horror movies. So that's going to be a bit of a disappointment for the horror fans this season.
I guess you just, you know, rained on his parade there when it comes to Red Rain.
Oh, thanks.
Indeed. What else have we got for science fiction this week?
Well, it's not all sad news for horror fans. If they're looking for ghost stories to read around Halloween, we've got two big books coming out. The first is Ghosts, Recent Hauntings, edited by Paula Garan, which reprints several stories written in the past couple of decades. A nice variety there. Meanwhile, Otto Penzler looks further back for the big book of ghost stories. This digs into the supernatural archives to pull out tales of urban ghosts, rural ghosts, fake ghosts, funny ghosts, every other kind of mischievous, mopey, and malevolent spirit. So if you want something to read around the campfire or keep you company on those chilly October nights, this is going to give you what you're looking for. In romance, we also have a touch of the supernatural. Lucy Munro's Dragon's Moon is her fourth Children of the Moon novel, and it blends paranormal elements with a historical romance set in the Scottish Highlands. The pairing up is between two shapeshifters. There's Chiara, who's a woman who becomes a wolf, and Eric, a man who can turn into a raven. And Munro draws stunningly evocative images of the experience of shifting shape. There are tender scenes between Chiara and her adoptive parents, sweet romances between side characters, including same-sex couples, which is not a common thing in this genre, and powerful passion between the leads. So this engaging tale is utterly captivating from start to finish, according to the PW review. We also review a delightful debut, Sultry with a Twist. This is a sweet mix of lighthearted romance and down-home charm. And Beckett draws spunky May, June, July, Augustine. How's that for a name? She very sensibly goes by June. And also Heart of Gold hero Luke Gallagher with a guileless energy that turns sappy stereotypes into genuinely endearing people. And set in a small town, ambitious June is bent on making her own way in the world, and the last thing she wants is to reconnect with her childhood sweetheart and her estranged tough love grandmother. But then a conniving judge from her hometown conjures up a month-long community service sentence that June has to serve alongside Luke while living with her grandmother. And the result is a likely hit with aw shucks romance fans, as everything works out well in the end.
Well, turning now to nonfiction, Rose, we've got a new work from James Wood, author of How Fiction Works.
Yeah, this is a collection of essays called In the Fun Stuff. It's 23 essays gathered from The New Republic, The London Review of Books, and The New Yorker. Our reviewer says it is further proof that he is one of the best readers writing today. To read his essays on the works of Norman Rush, Alexander Hemann, Leon Tolstoy, or Lydia Davis is to relieve the specific brand of joy created by a particular work of genius. Wood's reviews are never just evaluations. They are passionate, sensitive discourses on the variations of authorial voice, the nature of memory, and the burden of biography. We also cover a new book by academic and critic Camille Paglia, who says we are living in an age of visual vertigo and must relearn how to see. This is Glittering Images, a journey through art from Egypt to Star Wars, and that's a highly compelling, reflective, and imaginative history of images in Western art, beginning with the Luxor paintings of Queen Nefertari's Journey to the Afterlife, and ending with, of all things, Revenge of the Sith by filmmaker George Lucas, who she argues is the greatest contemporary master of synthesizing art and technology.
Well, when it comes to Camille Paglia, you know, she never says anything ordinary, and she also says it three times faster than anyone else. So great to hear that she has a new book out. What about audio?
Well, I think if she says the thing three times faster than everyone else, we can be glad that one's not an audiobook. But we have a
That's right.
We have a couple of great audiobooks in the audio section this week. Guilt by Degrees by Marcia Clark, read by January Lavoie. This is a mystery featuring Los Angeles Deputy District Attorney Rachel Knight and her best pal, homicide detective Bailey Keller. The two of them are struggling to solve the murder of a homeless man, but complicating their investigation is that the victim's identity is unknown. Also, Rachel has to deal with a vain, lazy coworker who resents her, a relentless hitman who's stalking her, a very clever villain who wants her dead, and a boyfriend who doesn't know what he wants. And January Lavoie turns in an energized standout performance that's totally in tune with Clark's zingy prose. Also, we have Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. This is Warren Littlefield's memoir with T.R. Pearson, and it's read by Bob Balaban. Now, if that sounds very appropriate, that's because Balaban himself played Littlefield in the film The Late Shift. So this is the Littlefield's recap of how NBC's Must-See TV made Thursday night the high point of the average television viewer's week, and he explains how he worked on Seinfeld, Friends, ER, Frasier, and other shows, giving all the juicy behind-the-scenes details. And this audio edition is very skillfully narrated, we say, by Bob Balaban, who himself also enjoyed great success in that era, playing the recurring role of NBC executive Russell Dalrymple on the show Seinfeld. In children's, we've got a big two-page roundup of Halloween picture books. It includes an interpretation of the classic Monster Mash song, a tribute to working mummies, and a very funny monster-themed twist on Hush, Little Baby. We also have a collection of grim epitaphs for various members of the animal kingdom. Elsewhere in picture books, we have reviews of new books from Jan Brett, Mossy, as well as the husband and wife team of Sarah Stewart and David Small, who wrote The Quiet Place. In fiction, we review a pair of YA books that tackle bullying and hate crimes targeting queer and trans kids. It's Trevor, a novella by James Lacine, and October Morning, a song for Matthew Shepard by Leslie Newman. We also review big fall books, again from Bob Balaban, actually, the guy who wrote The Creature from the Seventh Grade. Also Peter Dickinson's Earth and Air, Melissa Marr's Carnival of Souls, Ray Carson's The Crown of Embers, and Libba Bray's The Diviners. Finally, in the online annex, two Iraqi brothers with eyes for one beguiling woman are torn apart by love and war in Ali Hosseini's vibrant The Lemon Grove. And the pieces in Tom Liguerre's and Riley MacLeod's The Collection, short fiction from the transgender vanguard, cover a wide range of genres and shine a light on the dynamic milieu of transgender experiences. And that's it. There's no pick of the week this week, so that's the review of the reviews.
Well, thank you indeed, Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Nice to have you back.
Always good to be here.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.